Sameach again.
Chag Sameach.
And today is turned out to be one of my favorite feast days that technically is not a feast day, but is a important day. And when I was in Church of God, you know, I learned about the feast days now about 35 years ago, but they never kept this day. They never kept the Feast of First Fruit, and not sure why, but after studying and we find out, it's also called Resurrection Day, and it's the feast that commemorates Yeshua's resurrection as the first fruit, and the day that starts the count to Shavuot. So we go from, we talked about this last year at Shavuot, maybe we will this year again, from first fruit to first fruits. There is some confusion if people don't understand it, but today I'm really going to talk about what it is to be a first fruit. I'm going to talk about the first fruit to Yahweh and what it means to be a first fruit, the feast of first fruit. So I want to start in Exodus 4 and verse 21. Exodus 4 and verse 21 says, "And Yahweh said to Moses, as you go to return to Egypt, see all the wonders which I have put in your hand, and do them before Pharaoh. And I will make strong his heart, and he will not send away the people. And you shall speak to Pharaoh, so says Yahweh, my son, my firstborn is Israel. And I said to you, send my son away, and let him serve me, and you refused to send him. Behold, I am about to kill your son, your firstborn." So I want to go into the beginning of the message showing that firstborn and first fruit, it's interchangeable. You know, first fruit is dealing with mostly agriculture. Firstborn is dealing with people, but it's the same thing. A firstborn is the same as the first fruit. It's the very first of the production of something. Exodus 13. Exodus 13, I'll read 1 and 2, and then I'll drop down to verse 12. So we see here, though, in the one I just read in Exodus 4, that Israel is the firstborn of Yahweh. You know, we know that. We know that everything is in judicial order, and within judicial order, the plan of salvation for this 6,000 years, really 7,000 years, but the 6,000 years that we're living in, it's only to Israel. We know that. We know that when we went in the Messiah series, right, that Adam was a certain seed, you know, and Yahweh chose the seed of Adam from mankind. He chose that one seed into the garden. When Adam failed, he didn't say, okay, I'm going to throw him out, and now I'm going to work with Patel or Johnson or, you know, Gagliano or another seed. No, he still was working with the seed of Adam to Abraham, who was the first Hebrew, into the children of Israel, as Jacob's name was turned to Israel. And the whole 6,000 plan has been with Israel. We see that, you know, that the New Testament is not with the church. There's the word church is not in the Bible. It's a pagan word. It comes from the word circe. It's you don't see it. You see the word idah, which is congregation or assembly, and the same in the Greek. It's ecclesia, which is assembly or congregation. It's the people. Church is something that came hundreds of years later when you have a building with a steeple, and that comes from paganism. So we see that Yahweh is working with the congregation of Israel in the first covenant, and in the new covenant, who is he working with? The house of Israel and the house of Judah. Nothing changes. That's judicial order. The thing that changes is now anybody of any race or any place they live in the world can join Israel. You know, as we go out and we seek the sons of Israel, I've been blessed over the last 25 years or so to go around the world and to be able to meet Israelites from all four corners of the earth. But as you're looking for those Israelites, anybody that has a heart to Yahweh can join. It doesn't matter where they're coming from. But it doesn't take the fact away that they're joining the covenant of Israel. Israel is the first fruit. There is no other nation. There is no other people. There is no other family in the earth except for Israel that Yahweh is working with in covenant right now. When the Messiah returns, it's going to be different. We know he's going to go into covenant with every nation on earth. And after the millennium, we don't know. We're not really sure. But certainly it will be expanded. We don't know how Yahweh will expand it. Will we go to other planets? Maybe. There's a universe for something. But right now, it's specific. Yahweh is working through Israel. And if you want to be in the covenant with Yahweh, you have to join the tree of Israel. That's even in the new covenant that we see. Or in the New Testament, I should say. When we go to Exodus 13, 1 and 2. Yahweh spoke to Moses saying, set apart for me every firstborn, the one opening the womb among the sons of Israel, among men and among livestock, they shall be mine. Drop down to verse 12. And you shall set apart to Yahweh everyone opening the womb and every firstling, the offspring of animals which are yours, the males are Yahweh's. And every firstling of an ass you shall redeem with a flock animal. And if you do not redeem, you shall break its neck. And every firstborn of men among your sons you shall redeem. And it shall be when your sons ask you in the future, saying, what is this? You shall say to them, Yahweh brought us out from Egypt by the might of his hand from the house of slaves. And it happened when Pharaoh hardened himself against sending us away. Yahweh killed every firstborn in the land of Egypt, from the firstborn of men even to the firstborn of animals. On account of this, I sacrifice to Yahweh every one of the males opening the womb, and I redeem every firstborn of my sons. So that's very clear that we see. Also, we're going to see birthright has to deal with firstborn, because the birthright is only to the firstborn, you know, or it goes there. If the firstborn is rejected, it'll go to somebody else, as we see, but the birthright goes to the firstborn. So again, we're seeing here all firstborns belong to Yahweh. Why? Because in the world today, Yahweh is only working with firstborn. You know, Yeshua is the only begotten of the Father. He is the firstborn. And that's why I said that message that I give at Shavuot, from first fruit to first fruits. And in Corinthians, it says Yeshua is the first fruit, singular. We are the first fruits. So again, without his sacrifice of today, the day of first fruit, the day of resurrection, there'd be no Shavuot, the day of first fruits. You know, some people, like I said, because it's first fruit and first fruits, they get mixed up. That Shavuot is called the Feast of First Fruits. Yes, multiple. But this is called the Feast of First Fruit because it's about the resurrection. It's about Yeshua. This day is not about us, except for the fact without his resurrection, we wouldn't be there on Shavuot. Shavuot is about us. That's why you have the two loaves. They're leavened loaves. It's the only time there's a leavened sacrifice to Yahweh because they represent two. They represent the house of Israel and the house of Judah. They represent the people. But today is the first fruit. It's about the resurrection. And that's why all firstborn are holy, because Yeshua is the firstborn. And we are also a type of firstborn. Numbers 3 in verse 5. Now what happens? Actually, before that, maybe I'll mention that. We don't really have to go there. I went there many, many times in Exodus 19, 3 through 6, where Yahweh says to the children of Israel, he is going to make them a kingdom of priests. So from this point, when we see the pattern of Yahweh, what was the pattern? The pattern was that the house of Israel would be the first fruits to the world, right? The same way Adam was going to be the first fruit to society. That failed. So now he's working with Israel, and the same thing. Israel would be the first fruits of the world, the society. That didn't really work, we see, because as soon as Yahweh takes Israel out of Egypt and they get to Mount Sinai, the golden calf incident happens. And now the plan that Yahweh said in Exodus 19, I'm going to make you a kingdom of priests, it fails. The marriage covenant was never consummated. The agreement of the Torah was never given, only the Ten Commandments, because while Moses is up there getting the Torah, Israel is sinning. So at that point, the covenant is suspended, right? That's being made with Yahweh. And the fact of the priesthood being, every man would be the priest of his own family and they'd be a kingdom of priests, that's also suspended. What comes in between? The Levitical order. And that's why it talks about in Galatians that the Levitical order was added because of transgression. It was not Yahweh's purpose from the beginning to have a Levitical order. You didn't need it. If you had a kingdom of priests, why would you need the Levites? But since Israel rejected Yahweh's covenant, now what happens? Levi's the one tribe who didn't. At the golden calf, Levi was the one where Moses said, take your sword and every man kill his brother. And Levi did it. I think it was 24,000 that died in that day, if I'm not mistaken. It could be wrong. 12,000 or 24,000. I thought it was 24, but a lot that died in that day. And then Yahweh starts the Levitical order, which is only a bridge. It's something that's temporary. So it's not something there that was the original intent. But Yahweh's figuring out a way now. How do you get from Mount Sinai? Because they don't know how many years until the Messiah comes, that it's going to be 1,500 years. But Yahweh knows. And if he's saying, wow, while they're at my mountain, while Moses is here, they're already doing this. How on earth will they ever last 1,500 years until my son comes? And that's why he brings the Levitical order, the ceremonial law, that 5, 10, 20 times a day, every single thing they do, they're going to be ceremonially unclean, and their mind is just going to be focused on this day and night until the Messiah can come and bring real redemption. But they still need a mediator, and that's what Levi is. Numbers 3 and verse 5. Numbers 3 and verse 5 says, "And Yahweh spoke to Moses, saying, Bring the tribe of Levi near, and you shall cause it to stand before Aaron the priest, and they shall serve him, and keep his charge and the charge of all the congregation before the tent of meeting to do the service of the tabernacle." So again, remember, a lot of people miss this. They think that the Levites are the priests. No. The line of Aaron are the priests. The Levites are the servants to the priests. It's a big difference here. That only the line of Aaron can do the priestly duties, who are also Levites, but they're that line. But the regular Levites are there to serve them, to serve them. It's almost like today in the New Testament congregation, we have elders, right? And elders are the ones who do the priestly duties. They do the ordination. They do the baptism. And then we have deacons. Deacons are the servants to the elders. The deacons are the ones who serve. So it's the same thing here when you're looking at the Aaronic priests compared to the Levites. You have ones that are doing priestly duties. You have ones that are serving the priest. You have elders that are doing priestly duties. You have deacons that are serving them. I did a message on this at the feast a couple of years ago that was pretty good. And then he says, "And they shall keep all the vessels of the tent of the meeting and the charge of the sons of Israel to do the service of the tabernacle. And you shall give the Levites to Aaron and his son, giving they shall be given to him out of the sons of Israel." Drop down to verse 11. "And Yahweh spoke to Moses, saying, And I, behold, I have taken the Levites from the midst of the sons of Israel in the place of every firstborn opening a womb from the sons of Israel. And the Levites have become mine. For every firstborn is mine from the day I struck every firstborn in the land of Egypt. I have set apart to myself every firstborn in Israel. From men to animal, they are mine. I am Yahweh." So again, where Yahweh, like I said originally, he would have had the firstborn in each family of the tribes to be the priests. The golden calf incident ends that, and now we're having the Levites take that place instead of it. Numbers 8 in verse 14, Numbers 8, 14, we see again that the Levi was a substitute. 8:14. "And you shall separate the Levites from the midst of the sons of Israel, and the Levites shall become mine. And afterward, the Levites shall come in to serve in the tent of meeting, and you shall cleanse them and shall wave them a wave offering. For they are wholly given to me from among the sons of Israel, instead of the ones who open any womb. The firstborn of all from the sons of Israel, I have taken them to myself. For every firstborn among the sons of Israel, among man and among animal, is mine." Right? This is the premise we're getting. Firstborn and first fruits are holy to Yahweh. They're separated to Yahweh. "I have set them apart for myself in the day I smote every firstborn in the land of Egypt. And I take the Levites instead of every firstborn among the sons of Israel. And I've given the Levites as given to Aaron and to his sons from the midst of the sons of Israel to serve in the service of the sons of Israel and the tabernacle of the congregation and to atone for the sons of Israel. And there shall not be a plague among the sons of Israel to the sons of Israel by coming near to the sanctuary." So very clearly, the premise is pretty simple, what we're seeing. Let's go into now showing how birthright is the same. Firstborn, you know, is a birthright. That's all the birthright is being the firstborn. Genesis 43 and verse 33. Genesis 43 and verse 33. This is when the brothers of Joseph are coming in, right? That, you know, when Joseph is not telling them first who he is, and they're coming in to buy the grain. And a very interesting scripture, when they're sitting down to eat, right? Even when they're just having a meal there, look what it says. "And they sat before him," Joseph, "the firstborn according to his birthright, and the younger according to his youth. And the men were astonished, each to his neighbor." So we see even in that sense. Now, again, today, like I said, we're living in a world depending on where you come from. You know, I mean, we have a tiny little group here, right? And just in this little group, how many countries do we have represented? I can think of 4, 5, 6, at least 7 countries, I think, that are represented just here in this little room. At least 6, maybe 7. But the point is, in every country, there's different culture. That's why at the school, we always have a day where we're going over culture. that we let the people come up and show how you do a greeting in your country, you know. In America today, there used to be a greeting. It used to be in America years ago that if a lady walked by, a man would take his hat off. You know, he would always, like, maybe not bow, but give a way to the lady. It's not like that anymore in USA. But in other countries, it is that way. There's a certain way to greet a younger person. There's a certain way to greet an older person. There's a way to shake the hand like this or shake the hand like that. And we see, though, that in many places we've lost this culture. And because if it's not part of our culture, we don't see it as that important. And that's why judicial order, that's why in America, I think, is a big reason why people can't accept judicial order. Because there's no culture to anything. There's no culture. Older people are looked at as a burden. They're not looked at as, well, they're older, you have to respect them. You know, the whole culture of that has gone out the window. But we see here that, wow, just in the seating, right? They're coming in, they're sitting, and they're making sure the firstborn is sitting by his birthright and the younger according to his youth. And the men are astonished. So we have to make sure that we understand this, that a birthright is extremely important because it comes with blessings, certain blessings that come. 1 Chronicles 5:1 and 2 says, "And the sons of Reuben, the firstborn of Israel, for he was the firstborn. But since he defiled his father's bed, his birthright was given to the sons of Joseph, the son of Israel. And the genealogy is not counted according to the birthright, for Judah prevailed among his brothers, and from him was the chief ruler, but the birthright was Joseph." So it's two different things. You have the birthright and the scepter. The scepter is the kingship. We know that goes through David. But the birthright is something completely different. And it is conditional. It's not something that is just, hey, I'm the oldest one, everybody has to listen to me. You can lose your birthright. And actually, if you look in the Bible, I'm not going to say every time, but certainly majority of the time, the birthright holder lost. Esau and Jacob, Cain and Abel, right? Over here where we see Reuben and Joseph. You could go over story after story after story, and you see that the birthright holder lost his position. And I think it's important because as us being first fruits to Yahweh, right, and us having that position of the right of the firstborn, we got to be really careful. And that's why I say people who are converting to Judaism, you gave your birthright away. You know, you want to convert to Judaism, you just gave your birthright away. And you know what? You just joined the only tribe that's not part of the new covenant. So good luck if you convert to Judaism. You're giving it away. And what are you giving it away for? To stay in a defiled land that Yahweh's coming to judge? Like I say, I love being here. I love every day I'm here. I hope I'm here till the kingdom comes. But I would not give my birthright away to stay in Israel today and give up on losing out on the kingdom. There ain't no way on earth. And if Yahweh wants me here, he's kept me here now for 20 years, you know, since our ministry started in 97. And I'll stay here as long as he keeps me here. But if it's not his will to me be here, I am certainly not going to violate his word, turn and join a religion, because that's what you have to do. It's not that you're even joining a tribe. You're joining a religion that is a pagan religion started with Rabbi Akiva that hates our Messiah. That's what the whole religion is based on. Because all the people who believed in Messiah joined the new covenant. The ones who didn't join the new covenant went with Akiva and joined a new religion called modern Judaism, which is a pagan religion. It has nothing to do with Yahweh, and it's all built on rabbinical things and something else. So, like I said, it's a stark reality when we look at how many people lost their birthright. And we have to cherish that. We have to believe in that. And it is important because, again, the birthright we know is conditional. You can lose it, but we also know it brings a double blessing. The birthright. Joseph got a double blessing, right? Ephraim and Manasseh. Ephraim's name means, you know, double blessing, fruitful. If we go to Deuteronomy 21 in verse 15. He says, "If a man has two wives, the one loved and the other hated, and they have borne him sons, both the loved one and the hated one, and if the firstborn son was of her who was hated, then it shall be in the day that he causes his sons to inherit that which is his, he is not able to cause to inherit the firstborn son of the one loved before the firstborn son of the one hated, who is truly the firstborn. But he shall respect the firstborn, the son of the hated one, by giving him a double portion of all that he has, for he is the first fruit of his strength, the right of the firstborn is his. So we clearly see first fruit, firstborn is interchangeable. It's interchangeable, and clearly we see that it's a blessing, and you can't choose. If you had five children, you can't say, you know what, because I like this one better, or this one's more this, I'm going to give him the right of the firstborn. Although your firstborn can lose their inheritance, as we saw with Reuben. Now, why, when Reuben lost the right of the firstborn, why did it go to Joseph then, who was the 11th child that's born? Because technically, remember, the covenant that Jacob entered with Laban was not with Leah, it was with Rachel. So technically, the firstborn of Rachel really was the firstborn holder. But since Joseph wasn't born till later and all that happened, Reuben got the right of the firstborn, but when he disqualified himself, you know, years later, after Joseph was already born, the right of the firstborn went to Joseph, who had the legal right of it at that time. So, like we said, and many times in Scripture, we see the firstborn, even with Manasseh and Ephraim. You know, Manasseh was the older, but Ephraim got the right of the firstborn. So the firstborn gets a double portion. They're the leader. They're the first of inheritance in position to take over the household. And that's why it talks about in Revelation 20, right, the first resurrection is the better resurrection. It's the better resurrection. Why? Because if you were in the first resurrection, you are a firstborn. And the second death has no power over you. When after the 1,000 years are up, in Revelation 20, verse 11, and the rest of the dead are resurrected, and they're judged by their works, and some will get eternal life, and some will go to the lake of fire. It never says that they're children of Yahweh. It never even says they're glorified spirit beings. For all we know, they can just be the way Adam was when he was created. They could have a human body, a physical body, and just never die. If sin never came into the world, Adam and Eve would have never died. You know, their bodies would have never corroded. So we don't know. We really don't know. But we do know for certain, because it says it, that our resurrection is better. We know that. So whatever they are or they're not going to have the same predominance that we have as first fruits. The same way that we know Yeshua as the firstborn from the dead will always have the predominance over everybody. So even though he is willingly sacrificing part of his inheritance with us, he's doing it of his own free will, we always know he will for eternity have the glory, the predominance, because he created all of us. You know, so nobody is ever saying that we're looking for equality some way with Yeshua. Of course not. He will always be right underneath Yahweh the Father in second command. That's why he is the first of the first fruits. He is the waif sheaf offering, you know, the very thing that would be doing today if we were in those times. But it's important to understand that you never want to neglect the right of the firstborn that each of us has here. 2 Chronicles 21 and verse 1. We see this the same thing with Jehoshaphat, with the firstborn. And Jehoshaphat lay with his fathers and was buried with his fathers in the city of David. You know, still there today. They're still looking for the tombs of the kings. And his son Jehoram reigned in his place. And he had brothers, the sons of Jehoshaphat, Azariah and Yehiel and Zechariah and Azariah, maybe another Azariah, and Michael and Shephathiah. And all these were sons of Jehoshaphat, the king of Israel. And their father gave to them many gifts of silver and gold and of precious things with fortified cities of Judah. But he gave the kingdom to Jehoram, for he was the firstborn. So again, he could treat his children wonderful. He can give big inheritances, but the firstborn's got to go to the firstborn. You can't take that right away from the firstborn. Exodus 34 and verse 22. And you shall observe a feast of weeks for yourself, the first fruits of the harvest of wheat, Exodus 34, 22, and the feast of ingathering at the turn of the year. It's very interesting. Whenever the feast days are talking about the timing of them, you see it in an agricultural sense. Then you see the phrase of it is a little different. Like normally it's called the Feast of Sukkot because you're staying in temporary dwellings. But here when it's talking about the tithe and the agriculture, it's called the Feast of Ingathering because you're ingathering all the fruits. Verse 23, three times in the year, every male of yours shall be seen before the face of Adonai Yahweh, the Elohim of Israel. For I will expel nations from before your face and will make broad your territory, and no one will cover your land as you go up to appear before Yahweh your Elohim three times in the year. You shall not slaughter the blood of my sacrifice with leaven, nor the sacrifice of the Passover feast pass the night until morning. You shall bring the first of the first fruits of your ground to the house of Yahweh your Elohim. You shall not boil a kid in the milk of its mother. And Yahweh said to Moses, write these words for yourself, for in the mouth of these words I will cut a covenant with you and with Israel. So again, we see that the tithe is also a type of first fruit. It's not literally... Uh-oh. Sorry about that. The tithe is a type of first fruit, but to give you an example, what's the difference between a literal first fruit and a tithe? Well, if you have a garden, right, the first fruit is literally the first thing that comes out of it. So that's why, like now, we're in the month of Aviv. The fruit is, the grain is becoming mature, right? It's becoming mature. So what happens? You have to take your omer, which is two quarts. You take the first, you haven't cut anything down yet. So you're just taking the first thing you're cutting is your first fruit. And every Israelite was to take an omer, two quarts of that, and they would take it up to the temple, and that's the first fruit. Your tithe is a type of first fruit because it's the first 10%. But so it's a different measurement. Where the omer is simply a quart, it's a very small measurement. The tithe is 10% of your total harvest, whatever that is. But it's still a first fruit. Because like I said in the other message, it's not your last 10% that you give. It's your first 10%. You're tithing. It's the first 10% that you're giving to Yahweh. So they are similar. They're different in that tiny point, but they are similar. They are both first fruits in that sense. Malachi 3 and verse 7. Malachi the third chapter in verse 7. He says, from the days of your fathers, you have turned aside from my statutes and have not kept them. Return to me and I will return to you, says Yahweh of hosts. But you say, and what shall we return? Will a man rob Elohim? Yet you have robbed me. But you say, and what have we robbed you? In the tithe and the offering. You are cursed with a curse for the nation, all of it. You are robbing me. Bring all the tithe into the storehouse so that there may be food in my house, and test me now with this, says Yahweh of hosts, whether I will not open the windows of the heavens for you and pour out a blessing until there is no sufficiency or room to store it. And I will rebuke the devourer for you, and he shall not destroy the fruit of your ground against you, nor shall your vine miscarry against you in the field, says Yahweh of hosts. So here it is very clearly. Yahweh is saying they're robbing from him, and he's saying, how have you robbed from me? And he's saying in tithes and offering. Now, it's very interesting when you look at the Karaite movement. Some people want to say the Karaites know because they've been doing it for all this time. The reality of it is Karaites are not being, they don't go back to biblical time. They go back to medieval times that the Karaite movement started. I'm not saying it didn't start for good reason. People were getting away from oral law and whatnot. And the Karaites say, though, we do things according to the Bible. We don't follow the oral law. That's not totally true, because they do follow the oral law when it comes to tithing, because Jewish people don't tithe. I don't know if you realize that. They don't. And Karaites don't tithe. And I was talking with one of the so-called leaders of the Karaite movement a while back, and I was asking him, why don't you tithe? It's a commandment. And he said, oh, no, no, there's not a temple. We can't tithe. And I said, yeah, but it doesn't make a difference. Yahweh is very clear right here. Before there was a temple, there was tithing. Genesis 28, right? We read it the other day. That Genesis 28, when Jacob is there, hundreds of years before there was ever a temple, right? 700 years or whatever it was, that he's tithing. And he's saying to Yahweh that he'll tithe. And the tithe is something that is a principle that whatever we're increased of, because it belongs to Yahweh anyway, we give 10% back to him. And he said, oh, no, 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 without a temple, you can't tithe. So I said, well, I read the scripture to him. And I said, why not just separate it then? Why not take it and give to the poor? No, you can't give to the poor because that would be stealing. I'm like, so you'll keep it for yourself. That's not stealing. But if you give it to the poor, it's stealing. He's like, yeah. So I read him the scripture. I said, why not just separate it? Why not just separate all the tithe until a time that someone will make known or build a temple or whatever? He says, oh, no. Because once you separate it, then it's holy. But as long as I keep it in my pocket, it's not holy. So I said, okay. So as long as you keep all the money for yourself, then you're not doing anything wrong. But if you take the 10% and give it to the poor, then it's stealing. And he smiled and said, yeah. I said, well, you're a hypocrite. You're no different than the oral law of the Jews. You're doing the same thing. Because it's very, very clear, the tithe does not belong to us. It belongs to Yahweh. But you know what? You can't expect Judah to understand first fruits because they're not a first fruit, right? The same reason, why did Judah take the two Pesachs, the Pesach where we kill the lamb, and the second Haggadah where we celebrate, why did they bring it together? And why do they only celebrate the second Haggadah leaving Egypt? Because they don't have the Messiah sacrifice. So why on earth would they be keeping the Passover, the lamb that represents Yeshua, when they don't believe in Yeshua? It's that simple, you know, that Yahweh is not going to be mocked. The same reason why. Why do 99% of Christians and people not know the name Yahweh? Probably for their protection. Because Yahweh says, whoever takes the name of Yahweh in vain will not be held guiltless. So he allows them to use pagan names so that they don't have accountability to themselves for that. But for us, like we said yesterday, for us that do have eyes to see, for us that Yahweh is calling, for us that do have something to lose, that are first fruits, we better take this serious. And whether it's the first fruit of, like I said, our garden or our grain, or it's the first fruits of our income, our 10% that we're given to Yahweh, everything is sacred to Yahweh. And that's why we have to separate it, because it's Yahweh's. It's His. Let's go to the book of Hebrews now. We see Hebrews 7. Hebrews 7. Because, really interesting, as Hebrews 7 is talking about, since there's a changing in the priesthood, there's going to be a changing in the tithing system. Remember, before there was a temple, tithes went. Abraham tithed to Melchizedek. We don't know if all tithes went to Melchizedek or where they went. We certainly know when the temple was built that all the tithes definitely came into the temple to the Levites. But now that there's a changing of the priesthood in the New Testament, it's very clear that Paul tells us there's going to be a changing in the tithing system because Levites are not New Testament priests. But really interesting, I'm going to read the beginning here first and then we'll read later. He says, chapter 7, verse 1, for this Melchizedek, and like I always say, Melchizedek, it's a title, it's not a personal name, it's the King of Righteousness, for this King of Righteousness, King of Salem, King of the Most High Elohim, the one meeting Abraham returning from the slaughter of the kings and blessing him, to whom also Abraham divided a tenth from all, being first interpreted King of Righteousness, that's what Melchizedek means, and then also King of Salem, King of Jerusalem, which is King of Peace. And there's only one. There's only one King of Righteousness. There's only one King of Jerusalem is Yeshua. There's not another one. Whose father and mother are not written in the genealogies, right? He has no beginning, no end, nor the beginning of his days, nor the end of his life. But being the son of Elohim, his priesthood remains forever. Very clearly, it's Yeshua. Now behold how great this one was, to whom even the patriarch Abraham gave tithes and paid head tax. For they of the sons of Levi who received the priesthood were authorized by the Torah that they should take tithes from the people, even from their own brethren who also came out of the loins of Abraham. But this man who is not recorded in their genealogies took tithes from Abraham and blessed him who had received the promise. But it is beyond controversy that the inferior Abraham is blessed by his superior, Melchizedek. And here men who die receive the tithes, but there he of whom the scripture testify that he lives forever receives them. And though Abraham, as one may say, even Levi who received the tithes, was himself tithed, for he was yet in his father's loins when Melchizedek met him. So he's saying, you know, he's in the loins of Abraham, so it's like Levi is being tithed by this. He's using it as an analogy that's being used in this way. If we drop down to verse 11 now, let's go to 11, we'll read more. If therefore perfection had been reached by the Levitical priesthood, by which the Torah was enacted for the people, what further need was there for another priest to rise after the order of Melchizedek? Otherwise, the scriptures should have said that he would be after the order of Aaron. But as there is a change in the priesthood, of necessity a change in the instruction of the Torah also occurs. For he of whom these things were spoken was born of another tribe, of which no one ever ministered at the altar. For it is evident that our master has risen out of Judah, as to which tribe Moses spoke nothing concerning priesthood. And it is still more abundantly clear, because he said that another priest would arise according to the order of Melchizedek, who has not become so according to the law of a fleshly command, but according to the power of life which abides forever. For it is testified, you are a priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek. Psalm 110. And the change which took place in the former law was made on account of its weakness, and because it had fulfilled its usefulness. For the Levitical law perfected nothing but a bringing in of a better hope, through which we draw near to Elohim. And he confirmed it for us by an oath, for they became priests without an oath, but this man by an oath, as he said to him by David, Yahweh has sworn and will not lie, you are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. All these things make a better covenant because Yeshua is the surety. And these priests were many, but being mortal, they are prevented from continuing because of death. But this one, because he is immortal, has the priesthood which remains forever. And from this he is able to save forever those who come to Elohim through him, because he lives forever to intercede on their behalf. For this is the kind of priest, high priest proper for us, holy, harmless, undefiled, and separated from sinners, and having become higher than the heavens, who has no need, as do the high priest, to offer sacrifices day by day, first for his own sins, then for those of the people. For he did this once for all, offering up himself. For the Levitical law makes men high priests who are imperfect, but the word of the oath, which came after the Levitical law, appoints the Son, who is perfect forever. So very, very clearly, you know, he's using the whole situation with the Levitical order, showing that the tithe is being transferred now to Melchizedek. We know we're Melchizedek priests. But he's also showing the order of the tithe and the sanctity of the tithe that comes from there, and the weakness of the Levitical order that comes out of it. Hebrews 10 and verse 1. For the Levitical law had in it a shadow of good things to come, but not the substance of those things themselves. Appearing year by year with the same sacrifices which they offer continually, they are never able to perfect those who offered them. Otherwise, if they had been perfected, they would have ceased to be offered. For from henceforth their minds would not have driven them into the sins from which they once have been cleansed. But in those sacrifices they are remembered their sins year by year. For it is not possible for the blood of bulls and goats to take away the penalty of sins. So it's very clear that the Melchizedek order is the eternal order. And that's the why when Yeshua is killing the animal in the Garden of Eden, he's doing that as Melchizedek priest. It's an eternal order, we're told from Psalm 110. You know, and Yeshua is the eternal high priest of that order, and the sacrifices during the Levitical order was simply a reminder. It was a reminder of the people, and like I said, it was a temporary bridge that was there. But there's a changing in the tithing law because there's a changing in the priesthood. Since the Levitical priests were collecting the tithe while there was a temple, now the Melchizedek priests are collecting the tithe, but the purpose is the same. The tithe before was for what? It was to care for the sanctuary of Yahweh. The tithe is used the same as we have today. Just the priesthood has changed. So let's go now to 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 20. 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 20. And we see it says, but now Messiah has been raised from the dead. He became the first fruit of those having fallen asleep. For since through man came death, also through a man is a resurrection of the dead. For in Adam all die, so also Messiah all will be made alive, but each in his order. Messiah the first fruit, afterward those of Messiah at his coming. And it's kind of interesting when you're looking at these holy days that they're all connected to each other. Because if you don't keep Pesach, then you can't keep the Feast of Unleavened. And if you don't keep the Feast of Unleavened, then you're not going to keep the Feast of First Fruit. And if you don't keep the Feast of First Fruit, you can't start your count to Shavuot, and you're not going to keep your Shavuot. So all of these feasts are connected, and all through, of course, the blood of Yeshua, because he is the first fruit. Without his sacrifice, we wouldn't be first fruits. You know, if the first fruit is holy, so is the lump. Without his sacrifice and without him being resurrected of the dead, resurrected from the dead, where is our hope? You know, if today, if he died And everybody believed he was the Messiah, but his bones are still laying over there like they think in Tapiote, not far from here, is where that guy was digging a few years ago and claims they found the bones of Yeshua there in that grave. If his bones are still there and he wasn't resurrected, where is our hope? We don't have any hope. Our hope is in this day because our hope is that he was resurrected. And if he was resurrected, that means for sure we'll be resurrected. But if not, what good is it? That means we're all just going to die. You can live a good life if you live 50 years, 80 years, even 120 years. But you're going to die and that's going to be the end of it. But the fact that he was the first fruit, he's the first born from the dead. And that's why he has the right of the firstborn forever, means that we are going to have the same thing. Now we know it's a surety. We have the evidence because it's already happened. There's nothing that we have to doubt because he's already done it. And that's why they're looking for a third temple. You know, why are they looking for a third temple? Because they want to resurrect the Levitical order that has already been superseded. And I don't see any Levites that were raised from the dead. I don't see any Levites that are sitting at the right hand of the Father in heaven, like 13 scriptures in the Brit Hadashah tell us, even also in the Psalm 110, sit at my right hand till I make your enemies a footstool to your feet. But Yeshua certainly has. Zechariah 6 in verse 12. Zechariah the 6th chapter in verse 12. It says, "And speak to him, saying, so says Yahweh of hosts, saying, behold, the man whose name is the branch," right? From Isaiah 11, "a branch will come forth from the root of Jesse," right? Talking about the Messiah coming as the son of David. "And he shall spring out of his place, and he will build the sanctuary of Yahweh." Even he will build the sanctuary of Yahweh. "And he will bear the majesty, and he will sit and rule on the throne, and he will be a priest on his throne, and the council of peace will be between the two of them," between priest and king. Right? We said the firstborn gets the right of the firstborn, but the king has the right of the scepter, the birthright and the scepter, the two eternal promises. But Melchizedek has both of them. Melchizedek is king and priest. Melchizedek is taking something that Adam lost. Adam was offered to be king and priest in the garden. He lost it. And then what happened, as the plan of Yahweh went on, the two promises were separated. And Judah now has the scepter, the promise of kingship. Joseph has the birthright. But the Messiah, who has both, brings the both together. Just like he brings the two sticks together in the tribes, he brings the two promises together here, and he is the one that only has the authority to build the sanctuary of Yahweh. Nobody else has that authority. When David asked Yahweh to build the temple or the sanctuary at first, what did Yahweh say? "I've been traveling around all these years in a tent. Did I ever ask for a sanctuary?" "No, but you know what? Because your heart is right, you're asking for the right motive, I'll let you build it." He didn't allow him to build it at the tabernacle of David, where Yahweh will build the house for David. But he said, just north of here, I'll let you build it over there. And then when that sanctuary was destroyed by the Babylonians, after 70 years, Yahweh actually commanded the Israelites to come back and rebuild that sanctuary. So his hand was in there. It was in there. But today, Yahweh is not commanding anybody to build any sanctuary for him. Matter of fact, it says in Isaiah 66, "Heaven is my throne, earth is my footstool. Where's the house you'll build for me?" And Yahweh says, if they build a house for him now, he says, when you do a sacrifice, you shed blood, it's like breaking a dog's neck. You know, he said, it's like putting swine's blood on the altar. It will not be accepted by Yahweh, because only the Messiah has the authority to rebuild the sanctuary that's coming. We go to Colossians 1. He has the preeminence, nobody else. Colossians 1 and verse 12. Colossians 1 and verse 12 says, "So that you may joyfully give thanks to Elohim the Father, who has enlightened and made us a worthy inheritance of the saints, and has delivered us out of the authority of darkness and brought us into the kingdom of his beloved Son, in whom we have obtained salvation and forgiveness of sins, who is the image of the invisible Elohim, the right of the firstborn of all creation. For all things were created through him, the things in the heaven, the things in the earth, the visible, invisible, whether imperial thrones, dominions, angelic orders, or authorities. All things were in his hand and have been created by him. And he is before all things, and by him all things are sustained. And he is the head of the body, the congregation, who is the beginning, the firstborn of the resurrection of the dead, that he might be preeminent in all things. Because it pleased Elohim to complete all things in him, and through him making peace by the blood of his crucifixion, to reconcile all things to himself through him, whether the things on the earth or the things in the heavens. So very clearly, he has preeminence. He is the firstborn from the dead. 1 Peter 2 and verse 7. It says, then it is to you who believe that this honor is given, but to disobeying ones, he is the stone which those building rejected. This one became the head of the corner. He is a stone of stumbling and a rock of offense. And they stumble at it because they believe not the word for which they were appointed. But you are an elect race, a royal priesthood, a holy people, and a people for possession, that you should proclaim the praises of him who called you out of darkness to his precious light. You who then were not a people, but now are the people of Yahweh, who had not obtained mercy, who but now obtains the mercies poured out upon you. And it's very interesting that in Hosea 1, right, to Ephraim, what does he say? I will say to them who are not my people that you are the sons of the living Elohim. And he's actually quoting that scripture here, again, showing this is not talking to the Gentiles, but talking to Ephraimites, saying you were not a people, but now you are the people of Yahweh. And when you look at when Yeshua is resurrected and he's cooking the fish over there next to Topka, and he's telling them to put the net back into the water, and they pull the fish up and it almost breaks, and says there's 153. Why is that number very interesting? Because the gematria of the saying that they will not, he said to them, they are not my people, but you are now the sons of the living Elohim, is 153. So again, showing the connection to the Ephraimites. But this is the priesthood. This is the Melchizedek priesthood. This is the changing in the priesthood. That now the priesthood is a different priesthood, and we are first fruits through Yeshua. Melchizedek priest today, we are the first fruits from that kingdom. Romans 8 and verse 14. Romans, the 8th chapter, and verse 14. Romans 8 is an amazing chapter, all about the resurrection and all the different things. I'll start in verse 11, Romans 8 and verse 11. He says, but if the spirit of the one having raised Yeshua from the dead dwells in you, the one having raised the Messiah from the dead will also make your mortal bodies live through the indwelling of his spirit in you. Okay? Really important scripture there. If the spirit of Messiah is in you, then the same spirit that had him be raised from the dead will raise us up. Without the spirit in you, that's what makes you a first fruit, is the Holy Spirit. If you don't have the Holy Spirit, you're not a first fruit. So I've talked to people that were either never baptized or baptized incorrectly. And some of them say, when I was 10 years old in the Pentecostal church, I received the Holy Spirit. I don't feel the need for rebaptism. And I think, fine, I'm not pushing anybody for baptism, because in my mind, I'm thinking maybe they're not a first fruit. If somebody doesn't desire with all their heart, mind, soul, and strength to fight to be a first fruit and want to serve Yahweh, then maybe they're not a first fruit. That's not for me to decide. But like I said, for me, even though I was baptized by the right line, you know, and the right authority, I was baptized in the wrong name, it was easy for me to make the decision of rebaptism. I'm going to lose out on being a first fruit over a technicality because somebody baptized me incorrectly, you know. They're not asking me to cut my arm off. They weren't asking me for my firstborn child. I simply went in the water again and got wet again just for obedience, you know. Yeshua didn't have to be baptizing, yet he said, do it to fulfill all righteousness. So why on earth wouldn't I be rebaptized if I was rebaptized in the wrong name? You know, it doesn't make any sense. But I don't push it because maybe someone's not a first fruit. And if someone does not see the need for that, then they might not be a first fruit. So this is what he says here, though. It's very clear, though. Without the Spirit of Messiah living in you, you're not a first fruit. And there's only one way we get the Spirit. We know that from Acts 8. It's by the laying on the hands of the elders who have the authority to do it. He says, so then, brothers, we are debtors not to the flesh to live according to the flesh. For if you live according to the flesh, you're going to die. But if by the Spirit you put to death the practices of the body, you will live. For as many as are led by the Spirit of Elohim, these are the sons or children of Elohim. For you did not receive a spirit of slavery again to fear, but you received the spirit of sonship, by which we cry, Abba, Father, like we said, like Daddy. That this is what makes you a literal child and a first fruit. And this is why first fruits are holy. Because Yeshua was the first fruit, and we are first fruits. It's something sacred to Yahweh. The Spirit itself witnesses with our spirit that we are children of Yahweh. And if children, also heirs, truly heirs of Elohim and joint heirs of Messiah, if indeed we suffer together, that we may also be glorified together. Wow. So here it is. Yeshua is giving us co-heirs of the universe. Not of Mount Zion, not of Jerusalem, not of Israel, not of the Middle East, not of the earth, but the universe. He's giving us co-heirs of the universe because we're part of the Yahweh family. And that's why you're baptized into the name of Yeshua Yahweh. Because the same way when a man and a woman get married, the woman takes the name of the husband. When we're baptized, we're being born into the family of Yahweh or begotten into the family of Yahweh, and we're taking on the name. And that's why he says in Hebrews 1 that the son has inherited a better name than the father. Cherubs are not born into the family of Yahweh, and they use the generic name of Michael, Gabriel, Raphael, but the son has inherited a more excellent name, Yahshua, the name of the father, the name of Yahweh. And that's why we see the baptism from Acts 2 is in the name of Yeshua Yahweh. That's the name that people are baptized in, and the Bible tells us there's one name in heaven and earth for people to be saved. And since it's a family name, you know, it's important. And I say to people, if you were married for 25 years and all of a sudden you're cleaning your attic and you find your marriage certificate and you see that for some reason it was incorrect. They put the wrong name on there. They put the wrong last name. Would it mean you weren't married for 25 years? Of course not. But would you go down to City Hall and get that certificate corrected? Of course you would. Why would I want a certificate that says Petra and Don Johnson or Pizzadio or some false name? I wouldn't want it. So it wouldn't do anything to my marriage for the last 25 years, but I would want to go down there and correct it. And it's the same with rebaptism. You know, if you were baptized incorrectly in the name of Jesus, then why on earth wouldn't you want to be baptized and take the family name of Yahweh upon yourself? It's very clearly. But when you see this, it blows you away to think about it. It's enough to think about Yeshua and his predominance and his preeminence, which is always going to be eternally forever. But to think that in his love for us as his bride, right? Because husband and wife become one. And if we're becoming one with him, that means he wants to share this with us. He wants to share his predominance and preeminence. And he wants to share the universe with us. So, you know, it's the same when you're looking at first fruits, why this is so important. Because it's something that's sacred to Yahweh because his son is that first fruit. His son represents that, and that means all first fruits for eternity are something set apart to Yahweh. And when the point comes up, should we tithe? You know, the question comes up, should we tithe? We are the tithe. Of course we tithe because it's a first fruit. It's a type of first fruit that you're giving. The 10% is the first part of whatever increase you have. But also, our life, like we said, it's not just agriculture. It's not just money. It's our time. Every day we should be giving at minimum 10% to Yahweh of our time. And it's our life. Our life, we are the tithe. Look at the example, right? The Levi was taken out and was separated to serve the priesthood of Yahweh. And what did he say? He said, you're not to have any land. You're not to have possessions. You are my possession. I'll take care of you. So if that was only a shadow, then how much more the reality of Melchizedek? How much more the reality that we are the eternal priesthood, and now that's the same thing that Yeshua is saying. You belong to me. 1 Corinthians 6, 19 and 20. You were bought and paid for. You don't belong to yourself anymore. We are the tithe. Our life is the tithe to him. That everything we do is a sacrifice to him. Romans 12, 1 and 2. Romans 12, 1 and 2. And this is what he says. Melchizedek is not about sacrificing an animal. It's about being a living sacrifice. Therefore, brethren, I call on you through the compassion of Elohim to present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, pleasing to Elohim, which is your reasonable service. I think so. For the eternal creator of the world, who created everything, who has no beginning and no end, to come to this earth and go 9 months in the womb of a woman, to come out as a baby, to poop his diapers, and need somebody to change his diapers when he's the eternal creator, and to live in a human body for 30-something years, and to suffer sicknesses, suffer rejection, suffer humiliation, and all because he wants to know how we feel? Yeah, I think it's my reasonable service that I am going to sacrifice anything I can for him. And if not, then you know what? It's blasphemy. It really is. To think that everything he sacrificed for us, and then we want to say, oh, you know what? I got 60, 70, 80 years in this life. I want to live it for me. You know, I want to go out and I want to get my degree and I want to have a nice house and I want to have all these things for me. And whatever's left over, I'll throw the crumbs to Yahweh. It's not it. That's blasphemy. That's why the widow's mite is such a powerful example. Because here it is, right? And everybody's throwing in a lot of money out of their access. But she throws in two little coins, and they said, what's that? And what was the answer? It was all she had. It was everything. It was everything this woman had was going to Yahweh. So it doesn't matter, because you know what? You could be a great talented person, and yet you're only giving Yahweh the crumbs of your talent. And yet there's somebody else that maybe doesn't have that much talent. That's why I love going to the third world, because I see people like this. I see people that don't have a lot of talent physically. I see people that are the simplest people in the world, and yet they give everything to Yahweh. Whatever they have, they give to it. I tell that story with the man who was crippled. Why? Because he got hit by a car, and they had no money to go to a hospital. So his leg, instead of getting it set right, it just grew bent, and he had to walk like that. And as we're building this sanctuary for them, and he's picking up these bricks with his cane and trying to walk. And I'm like, brother, you don't have to do that. We can handle it. He said, no, it is an honor to lay a stone in the house of Yahweh. It's like, wow, these people are willing to give every single thing they have, which it might not be much, but it's all they have. And for us that may have more abundance, what are we giving? And like I said, material things is easy. That's the easiest thing. I know it. I lived in the States. I had a lot of money. The easiest thing is to write out a check. You know, that doesn't take so much. Although it's required of us, that doesn't take. I'm talking about to give of yourself, to give of your heart, to give of your time, to give of your talents, you know, what they are. That's what Yahweh wants. He wants us to give it of ourselves. And every time we give to each other, we're given to him. Isn't that Matthew 25? When I was hungry, you fed me. When I was in prison, you visited me. When we give to each other, we're giving to him. And this is what it's all about. Because you know something? Yeshua is the first fruit. And we are also a type of first fruits that is coming. And I'm not a first fruit. We are first fruits. Collectively, we're first fruits. So think of him as maybe like an apple. And all of us are little pieces of an apple cut up. Maybe, you know, 200,000 little pieces. So yeah, I'm a first fruit as much as you're a first fruit. But I'm not a first fruit of my own, you know. We're first fruits collectively. And that's why it's important to him that he doesn't need anything. He owns the universe. What's important to him is that we are living sacrifices every day to each other. That we're loving each other. We're caring for each other. We're working together. And this is what pleases him, you know. There's nothing that pleases Yahweh more, Psalm 133, than when the people are dwelling together in unity. And this is what he wants and this is what he expects. And this is what he asks of us. Revelation 5, 9 and 10. We'll be ending here in a few minutes. Revelation 5 and verse 9 and 10. And they sing a new song, saying, worthy are you to receive the scroll and open its seals. because you were slain and by your blood purchased them to Elohim out of every tribe and tongue and people and nation, and made them kings and priests to our Elohim, and they shall reign on the earth. Right? By his blood we were purchased back to Yahweh. We are only a first fruit because he's a first fruit. Like, if the first fruit is holy, so is the lump. And like I said, if his bones are laying in some tomb over there in Tapiot, we got a big problem. But they're not. They're not laying in a tomb in Tapiot because he wasn't even buried in Tapiot. He was buried in Jerusalem, you know. And this was not part of the old city even in that day. It was ridiculous. It doesn't fit. But the point of it is that we are only first fruits because he is the first fruit. And yet he's willing to sacrifice everything of his inheritance with us. What are we willing to sacrifice with each other? Revelation 7 and verse 13. Just one page over. Revelation 7 and verse 13. And one of the elders answered, saying to me, "These, the ones having been clothed in the white robes, are they? Who are they and where did they come from?" And I said to him, "Sir, you know." And he said, "These are those coming out of great affliction, and they wash their robes and whiten them in the blood of the Lamb. Because of this, they are before the throne of Elohim, and they serve him day and night at his sanctuary. And he sitting on the throne will tabernacle over them. And they will not hunger still, nor will they thirst still, nor at all shall fall on them the sun, nor any kind of heat. Because the Lamb in the midst of the throne will shepherd them, and will lead them on springs of waters, living waters. And Yahweh will wipe every tear from their eyes." So like I always say, kingdom principle is, we don't own anything in the kingdom. Everything belongs to Yahweh. And people think, well, how can I survive? And the point is, you don't own anything because you don't need anything. It's so neat when we go on kibbutz day and we're out there on the kibbutz and you're seeing it in practicality because it's a real kibbutz and these are real people living there. And then all of a sudden, you know, when people are saying, well, if you don't own clothes, if the clothes belong to everybody, how do I wear clothes? And then you go to the place and you see where you need a shirt, just pick one. And you see bin after bin after bin, how they wash all the clothes. And it's somebody's job. So when you come with your clothes, you put your shirts in the male shirts. You put your tallit in the tallit one. And it's really neat. And then it's like, but you know, what if I'm working off the kibbutz? How do I get there? I don't own a car. Look, there's 100 cars. Pick one. It's yours. Take it. And when you're done, bring it back. And then somebody else uses it. It's so neat to think that the day will come that we don't have anything because we don't need anything. Yahweh is my shepherd. I will not want. When he is our shepherd and we trust in him, you have no want. You have everything you need, right? And if your life is constantly feeling uneasy or unhappy, then Yahweh is not your shepherd. Because when he's your shepherd, you just have no need. And that's the kingdom principle. And that's why I say I am so excited to see the kibbutzes working this way. Because that's the way the kibbutz is working. It's such a model. And again, not everything of the kibbutz model we know is from Yahweh. But this part is, you give everything you have and you take what you need. And everybody is working together toward the same common goal of the kingdom. We're sacrificing our mind toward the mind of Messiah. So just as the Levite took his temple service most serious in the Old Covenant, we must take our temple service as living stones and priests of the sacred Melchizedek priestly order, just as sacred, even more sacred. Because like I said, that was only a shadow. That was something created by Yahweh at Mount Sinai. This is an eternal order that we have. If not, we are selling our birthright. Remember, Esau had a birthright, and he sold it for a bowl of pottage, you know, lentils. I love my wife's lentils, but I don't think I'd sell my birthright for it, you know. And you think about it. You know, you read that story, and he's coming in, you know, and he's huffing and puffing. He's out there hunting. And, oh, what good is this birthright? I'm going to die. And I don't doubt he was hungry. I don't doubt he might have went a while without having food. I do doubt he was going to die. I doubt very much that if he didn't get that bowl of lentils right there, that he would have dropped down and dead. And you know something? Even if he did, he would have died with the birthright. I'd much rather die with a birthright than a bowl of lentils, you know, if you have to choose from it. Can you imagine? And we could laugh at that, but it's really sad because many believers are giving their birthright up for even less. Many believers are giving their birthright up for less. What on earth are you selling your birthright for? It's something that we have to think about. as a first fruit every day of our life. It's something we have to cherish and we have to praise. We have to thank Yahweh for the life he's taking us out of. And to think that, wow, this eternal order that we don't know what it was doing before Yahweh created the earth. But it says it's an eternal order. So this Melchizedek order was always there. We know it will be there in the future. And that he's chosen us to be part of that. He's chosen us that we literally are going to be a king and a priest and part of that order. Praise Yah. So the Feast of First Fruit, which symbolizes the resurrection and Yeshua being the firstborn from the dead, having eternal predominance over that. But also, it's the first day of the count to first fruits. How wonderful to be a first fruit. Yahweh bless. Chag Sameach.